the Mossad, so to speak, in some way was very much beneath him.
Is it the opposite then? Did Mossad work for him?
It's more like that, yeah.
Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender whose name still dominates headlines years after his death in a U.S. prison cell. Whether it's revelations about his crimes, or the U.S. Congress passing a bill to force the release of the Epstein files, or the powerful network of elites who surrounded him. But recently, a new series of reports by DropSite News has opened up another angle. Epstein's ties to Israeli intelligence. Did Epstein broker security deals on behalf of Israeli intelligence? And what about his relationships with key Israeli figures, including former Prime Minister Ehud Barak? I'm about to get into that and more with Murtaza Hussain, National Security and Foreign Affairs reporter at DropSite, who has been investigating these links along with his colleague Ryan Grimm. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk. And he joins us from New York. Murtaza Hussain, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Nah, absolutely. Look, there's a lot for us to get into. But before we even try to understand Epstein's relationship with Israeli intelligence, you've been doing, you know, ever since you put out these reports, I'm kind of curious as to what your observations were, Murtaza, about how the reactions were so far.
Yeah, it's been interesting because you know, everyone in the U.S. at least is covering Epstein very intensely. It's become like a central issue in U.S. politics, at least recently. And, you know, there were even allegations that the government shutdown in the U.S. Was related to trying to delay or suppress disclosure of more emails and other information from Epstein's estate, what the people call the Epstein files. So everyone's talking about it, but no one's talking about this particular angle. And I think it's actually the most important angle, arguably. The people are talking about his involvement in sex trafficking, and that is extremely important, and it's a very grave crimes he was involved in. But that does not really fill in the blanks of who Epstein was, how he was so powerful, how he had all his money, what his relationship was with all these very powerful people who sought his counsel, who his calendar show were at his house a lot in New York, in his apartment in New York as well too, and other residences he owned around the world. And most importantly, in my view, his extensive ties with foreign intelligence agencies and foreign governments. That's the focus of our story. And, you know, regarding the media reaction, they have really not engaged with that part very much at all. They've tried to, in my view, even purposely avoid it. Except that because of the pace and the scope and the incredible detail of our reporting, it's kind of forced them to surface a little bit in the media. And there were some interesting sort of interactions on CNN and the New York Times Deal Book Summit and so forth, where people cited our reporting to confront.
I saw the one with Marjorie Taylor Greene on CNN. Yeah.
Exactly. Marjorie Taylor Greene brought up Epstein's involvement in some of these Israeli security deals. And she was talking to CNN host Dana Bash in that context.
And I think the right question is to ask is, was Jeffrey Epstein working for Israel? And I'm proud to say I don't take money from AIPAC. I don't take money from any special group of people. I'm just representing my district and the American people. And so that's what I was referring to.
I just want to be clear. Are you saying Israel is pushing the president of the United States to cover up the Epstein files? And what evidence do you have that that is the case?
I simply just asked out loud, is there a foreign government? And it could be any foreign government, but is a foreign government pushing to keep this covered up? Because people just don't understand the big fight against.
Well, you had AIPAC up there. It was pretty clear which government you were talking about.
The funny thing is that the story that Ms. Green was referencing actually also mentioned Dana Bash's ex-husband. So if you would go back and look at that clip, yeah, Jeremy Bash was somebody who was liaising with Israeli intelligence, an Israeli intelligence agent who was staying at Epstein's home in New York. And she was obviously Dana Bash's ex-husband. So, you know, if you look at that clip, she's really angry at Marjorie Taylor Greene. And there are a lot of layers to that, because not only is she bringing up something that was not supposed to be brought up on CNN, she was bringing up a story which the host's own, you know, family member was involved in. So, you know, I think that people are not comfortable with these stories. They don't want to have it brought into public attention. The problem is that we have a lot of detail about this. It's all public, and, you know, people just choose not to report it. And, you know, these stories are based on large part, not exclusively, but on large part on leaked emails from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak showing his dealings with Epstein. We have a lot more coming. And, you know, they're a little difficult to report. They're a little complicated and so forth. But they're all sitting there. And more stories are going to come out. And it'll be harder for people to ignore the very broad ties that Epstein had, not just to Barak, but a lot of people in the Israeli security establishment, and the role he played in even doing back-channel diplomacy for Israel. Something we've covered a little bit, and I think there's more details about that to show.
And how'd you, we're going to get into that shortly, but how'd you react to Netanyahu sharing that Jacobin article on X? Because that article also references your drop site reporting, and it's an article basically talking about Ehud Barak Jeffrey Epstein meddling in Israeli elections.
So this is an interesting kind of subtext to all this, which is that Netanyahu, I imagine he shared the article not because he wanted to promote those claims per se, Epstein's ties to Israel in general, but Epstein is like a weapon. He's a political weapon both in the U.S. and in Israel, in the sense that you can use association with him to tar the reputations of your political rivals. That's what they're doing, basically. So Netanyahu and Ehud Barak are very much, you know, the enemies, basically, politically. And Netanyahu's frequently used Barak's association with Epstein to damage his reputation, to wound him in various ways. It's interesting because we're not the first people to report that Barak and Epstein had a relationship. Our reporting is more about the Israeli intelligence security angle and what they're doing together. But, you know, the idea that they had a relationship was known. But it was actually reported most extensively by these far-right or right-wing U.S. and British outlets like the New York Post and Daily Mail. And they focused on, you know, alleging that Ehud Barak was involved in Epstein's sex trafficking and, you know, abusing girls and so forth. And these are very right-wing pro-Israel outlets, actually. So it's kind of funny that they're the ones who report this. But the reason is that this is all Israeli domestic political realities, that these kind of right-wing American and British outlets, they're very tied to Netanyahu personally. Whereas Ehud Barak, you know, at least in the Israeli context, he's kind of like more liberal than Netanyahu. So he's part of the labor coalition.
Yeah, he's seen as more left wing, right? I mean, relative to Israeli politics, of course.
Exactly. And Epstein, it seems like Epstein was sort of part of this nexus of political actors that spanned the Israeli Labor Party, the British Labor Party, and the Democratic Party in the U.S. That was kind of his bubble that he was in, his ties to the Clintons and stuff like that. Everyone's trying to make this about Trump in the U.S., and Trump did have an association with Epstein, but it seems like it was much less extensive than the Clintons and so forth, the Democratic Party people who Epstein was aligned with. So Netanyahu sees himself as being at war with this liberal deep state. That's kind of his self-perception. He thinks that he's being besieged by them with his corruption trials. And the way he's striking back is sharing like this Jacobin article about Barak and his ties to Epstein to kind of suggest that, you know, Epstein is part of that world that was antagonizing him. The thing is that no one really outside Israel looks at it that way. People are looking at the association with Israel in general as a problem, as opposed to delineating which party or which figure he was most tied to. It's really not relevant. But I think that that's the reason Netanyahu shared it, because he's trying to further injure Barak in a personal manner politically. And he ironically saw this article as a way of doing that.
Yeah. And that, but also, I guess he inadvertently like shine a big spotlight on it as well, in a way.
Exactly. Which is what people in Israel are really angry about, to be honest, because like Naftali Bennett and other people don't like Netanyahu because they're a little smarter. They understood that, you're bringing attention to the story, which is being reported and which we're trying to ignore. We're trying to make sure that nobody engages with this, because the second you engage with it, it becomes real and a central issue in politics. And after Netanyahu shared that, it was funny because some American conservative media figures who were very popular, they started reposting it and talking about the fact that the article talks very frankly about Epstein's involvement in Israeli intelligence and security affairs. And then Naftali Bennett and other people in Israel were trying to intervene publicly to suppress that again and to tamp down these rumors that Netanyahu had, you know, inadvertently or not, had helped add fire to. So I think what they're going to continue to try to do is just ignore the reporting as much as possible. But like I said, I think it's going to be very difficult to ignore. It's going to be hard to ignore because it's just so much evidence. And, you can try to ignore it politically, But other people, you know, a lot of people read Dropsat News. We're publishing this. We have about 500,000 subscribers.
Yeah.
A lot of people in other news organizations read Dropsat News. They want in on the story. It's a really good story, and only we've been covering it. But I think that that dam is going to break at some point, and it's going to be harder and harder to just pretend this is not happening and not engage with it.
And for viewers who don't know, Dropsat is an alternative media outlet. But I do want to ask you, let's just get into it right away. I mean, what is it that we know right now from your reporting about Epstein's relationship to Israeli intelligence services?
Yeah, so we've run about 6 stories so far based, and like I said, large part, not entirely on Epstein's emails with Barak and their subsequent emails with other people in the Israeli intelligence establishment and foreign governments and the meetings they're setting up together. So to give you a quick summary, you know, we did a story about how Epstein and Barak worked together to help organize and ultimately execute an Israeli security deal with Mongolia in the 2010s.
And they Cote d'Ivoire later.
Similar thing, Cote d'Ivoire later. We have other stories coming about Nigeria and other places that they were did the, kind of the same thing. Also, Epstein was involved in doing high-level back-channel diplomacy between the Israeli government and the Russian government in 2013 over the Syria war. We did a very extensive story, but that Epstein was the one who was setting up meetings between Barak and Putin and so forth to try to create these track two dialogues, like, so, you know, back channel dialogues that were intended to be the basis for more formal discussions later on. Epstein was a person that, you know, he is tied to the Russians and the Israelis, so he was in the ideal position to help organize and execute it. And he also helped shape Barak's messaging on the subject, which was intended to send messages to Russia and also shape public opinion in the U.S. to try to actually incentivize the U.S. to attack Iran and also intervene more forcefully in Syria in 2013. He was involved in that. And, you know, another story we did, which I think was the story which, again, a lot of attention in the U.S., and I referenced it earlier regarding the Marjorie Taylor Greene's interactions with Dana Bash. A senior Israeli military intelligence officer was living in Epstein's apartment in New York.
Yeah, Yoni Korin.
In Manhattan. Yoni Korin on multiple occasions. Yoni Korin was also Barak's longtime chief of staff. And that story shows a lot of the spycraft and other things that they were engaged in New York. Korin was basically the liaison between Israeli intelligence and U.S. intelligence at the time. But also, you know, many years ago, it was probably like 12 years ago now, I reported on the Edward Snowden documents with Glenn Greenwald. And one thing that was interesting, those documents, is that they show that Korin and Barak were actually under NSA surveillance in New York at the same time that we now have these emails about them. So there was a lot of things going on there. We don't really know what Korin was doing in Epstein's home. No one's ever really explained it. He was there multiple occasions for extended periods of time, weeks at a time sometimes. So, you know, this led to the questions of, like, where blackmail, was he helping blackmail people who were sleeping with young women at Epstein's home? I don't have a definitive answer to that, but certainly that does raise a legitimate concern about that.
But,
and then finally,
go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to say very briefly, this story is not related to Israeli intelligence per se, and it's something that didn't come from the Barak emails. It came from a separate tranche of emails we have from Epstein's Yahoo account, which we're also still going through. But, you know, Epstein was involved in smearing the authors of this 2007 book called The Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy, one of John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. Epstein was a very powerful figure at Harvard. We can talk about why he was later, but he was an extremely influential donor and political figure at Harvard University, and he was involved in helping, you know, promote a smear against them as anti-Semitic in that year, which also, you know, it shows the corruption at Harvard that he was involved in, but also his own political views. He was a very, like, extreme pro-Israel, pro-Zionist kind of figure, you could say, in the U.S. political landscape.
What I was going to say just a second ago, mentioning Yoni Korin, the fact that you had an Israeli intelligence officer living at Epstein's house or estate, because, you know, we saw basically officials from the U.S. government resisting to release the Epstein files because they argued that it touches on national security. But the Korin stuff, if I'm not mistaken, it came out in the House Oversight Committee files that they pushed out. And it's almost like, well, the government doesn't want to put it out because it touches on national security. But then it's also giving you this big, you know, key, topic to look at. at, which is the fact that you had an Israeli intelligence officer who's staying at Epstein's house and expecting as if media isn't gonna follow up on that.
Well, you know, that's a really important point you just made because, let me back up. That story was built partly on those calendars that you referred to that were released by the House Oversight Committee that showed that Cohen was staying at Epstein's home. But also, the Barack emails had pretty significant correspondence between Barack, Cohen, and Epstein at the same time. So it was the two together which actually kind of filled in the whole story. Or much more of the story, I would say, at least. Because it's interesting. They released the calendar showing Korn's name on there. And a lot of other things are redacted in the calendars, but that wasn't redacted. I think that part of the issue is that, first of all, maybe they didn't expect anyone's going to look into this very deeply in the media. Secondly, you know, the calendars themselves, they do tell you who's staying there, but they don't really tell you any much more beyond that. But our emails show that, you know, they were engaging in some sort of strange spycraft, coded behavior and so forth. But also, Epstein was transferring money to Cohen for some reason during this time as well, too. So there were substantive interactions between them. So the two things together kind of flesh out the story a bit more. And there are also pictures of Cohen in New York with Barack at that time that we are in the inbox. So that all adds up to something quite interesting. But, you know, also, like, when they're doing these things, when they're releasing these documents with their actions, they do make mistakes. They do forget to redact things. They do, even a heavily vetted document by the CIA and NSA and whoever else will contain errors. They'll fail to redact things or redact things inconsistently and so forth. I think in this case, they didn't really expect our stories to come out. They didn't expect anyone's going to cover this angle of the story or drill down on it so specifically. And now maybe when the next tranche of Epstein files comes out, they'll be more aggressive in their redactions. That's definitely possible. But yeah, they did give us that detail. And it's funny, Dropside News, like, we're just like seven people, you know, it's not that many of us. We don't have a huge budget or anything. But we're the ones who actually looked at this. No one else seemed to have the incentive or the capability to do so. But that's what they did, actually give us that information, wittingly or not, when they released the first tranche of the Epstein files, so that tranche.
Right. And if we talk about the source of all this information, I think there's two or three main sources that basically gave you everything to put the lines together. I think it was the House Oversight Committee files that they pushed out, and then there's the, I guess it was Ehud Barak's emails from the pro-Palestinian hacking group Handala, which was a leak, basically. And I think the third thing, if I'm not mistaken, is Jeffrey Epstein's Yahoo emails, which were also leaked. Am I correct in those?
Yeah, you've been paying close attention. That's exactly right. That's the calendars. It's the emails from Barack with Barack. That's from a email, JEE Vacation. There's multiple different emails that he uses. One called JEE Project, JEE Vacation. He uses them for different things. But yeah, those emails are in the Barack inbox as well, too. And then, you know, the federal government, the U.S. House Oversight Committee, I should say, they have released some other emails from Epstein's correspondences. And, you know, some of those emails are redacted, and they're very fragmentary. They don't really have all the information and so forth. But, you know, they're helpful because the emails that the government released helped us even further verify some of the Barack emails, because they showed up in both the archives. So it's all those things, the calendars and so forth, they all kind of add up together to give us information.
You're actually answering something that I was going to follow up with, because I think because of the fact that Barack's emails were part of a leak of a pro-Palestinian hacking group, the Handala, people might ask, well, how did you verify that these emails were really Barack's, you know, without a shadow of a doubt?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, we reported these stories, but we're not the first people to draw on those email inboxes. There was also a story by Reason Magazine that did the first story based on the Handala inboxes, and it was kind of high level about Epstein's ties to people in the tech world and so forth. But they went through a process of verification, and then we did our own process of verification. We verified some of the non-public information that was in there as being accurate. We contacted people whose information was in there, which was not publicly known, just to verify certain details and so forth. And that helped give further verification and veracity to the documents, so to speak. And then, you know, after that, you know, there was other verification took place. Like I mentioned, the House Oversight Committee releases verified things further. you know, we talked to people who were in the documents, and they told us certain things, which we were able to nail down further. So that all together kind of added up more. And we also did some other technical verification of the timestamps and so forth, which gave us further information about the origins and veracity of the documents. So all that together, I think, gave us pretty strong confidence. And I think this time, I think it's pretty much not really disputed that our emails are accurate. But yeah, it's gone through multiple layers. And with the passage of more time, I think we get more information about this.
All right. Well, let's talk about it. I mean, let me ask you about Epstein's relationship with the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak. Just based on your reporting, the summary of what you guys came out with, I'm also going to tell you my own personal impression from reading your reporting, from reading the emails and the correspondence between the two. It's so interesting because it's almost you forget that Barak was a prime minister. You know, it feels like the relationship between Epstein and Barak is actually a bit inverted. I think if the emails didn't exist, you might think that Epstein would have been, you know, different in the way that he approached Barak or in the way that they spoke because of the fact that this is an ex-head of government. But actually, Barak doesn't carry himself like a former prime minister at all. If you didn't know, you wouldn't have guessed is what I'm trying to get at.
That's a really important point, because the power dynamic in the emails you pointed to, and the power dynamic, you know, you think that Barak is higher and more powerful than Epstein. He was the prime minister of Israel. He was just the defense minister. He was defense minister during the time they were corresponding for part of that. But really, it seems inverted that, like you said, Barak is really looking up to Epstein for information, for advice, for connections, for help making money once he left office. It wasn't by any means that Epstein was seeking out Barak or trying to get his attention and things like that. It was the opposite, if anything. Barak was really looking for Epstein's support. So I think that's very revealing. That's revealing of something very interesting here, that who exactly was Epstein that he had more power and influence than the Israeli prime minister? Why did the Israeli prime minister or former prime minister at this time, or defense minister, need his help to make connections with elite Russian intelligence officials and political officials, or to make connections in, you know, Africa or Central Asia or wherever else it is? Who did Epstein represent that he would be in that position of superiority, so to speak, over Barak? That's a really interesting question, which I hope we can dig into a bit further in a subsequent reporting, but it absolutely is the case in those emails. I think that your read is basically correct, that you know, we're looking at a situation wherein Epstein represented, whoever he was, whoever he represented, was, you know, somewhere higher on a hierarchy than public officials like Barak, even people like him who were, you know, extremely influential within their own countries.
And what's our understanding of it? Is it the fact that Barak was basically looking to make money after he left office, and he was going to Epstein, I guess, for help in a way of dealing with certain governments in terms of Barak's relationship with the intelligence services or whatnot? Like, what is it that these two were trying to get out of each other?
Well, you know, in Israel, it seems that the line between public and private life is quite permeable. It's not really as a red line as it is maybe in other countries, in the US or UK or whatever. And in Israel also, a lot of people serve in the intelligence agencies or military conscription and so forth. So, you know, that's a very lifelong kind of commitment. So, you know, in like the US and UK and so forth, it's kind of common that people, once they leave public office, they will try to go to the private sector and bank the connections that they made in public life to start making money now. It's like the revolving door between the corporate world and the political world. So Israel seems like it's the same in a way. So Epstein was like a fixer for Barak when he left his defense ministry role. And they were, to be clear, they were working together and communicating while he was still defense minister as well. But, you know, once he left, he was very urgent. Barak especially, urgent desire to make money. And he thanked Epstein numerous occasions for helping him do that, helping him, you know, set up a consulting business, helping him find clients and contracts around the world where he can pitch these the services of these Israeli surveillance technology firms to foreign governments. You banking on his reputation as the defense minister and the famous prime minister and so forth. So Epstein was helping him do that, helping him make money in that role. But also, there was a dual purpose here. everything they did served multiple different goals at once, in that he was effectively also helping further the Israeli security and political interests while he was making money. So Barak didn't really stop serving Israel after he left office. He continued serving it. I would say even today, he's ostensibly a private citizen. He's still like doing things for Israel, by all means. I don't think that you ever really stop serving when you're at that high level and that many years in public service or intelligence service. You continue doing that service your whole life. So, you know, in that role, he was helping promote these firms, these Israeli tech firms, surveillance tech firms in foreign countries. But in doing so, those deals, private sector deals, laid the groundwork for formal security arrangements that were later signed in Mongolia and Cote d'Ivoire and, you know, and elsewhere in Africa and Central Asia and beyond that. But also, he was engaged in direct track two diplomacy for the Israeli government with foreign governments. And that's what we saw in his negotiations with Putin, his contacts with Putin that Epstein helped set up. Barak was still sort of trying to do diplomacy for Israel, even while he was a private citizen, to help lay the groundwork for more formal diplomatic arrangements between Israel and Moscow down the line. And Epstein, again, was there helping him do that. So it wasn't that he was just helping him make money, although he was doing that. They were trying to do multiple things at the same time. It was like a well-oiled machine wherein Epstein and Barak would work together to generate revenue, turn these relationships into cash flows that were useful to Barak, but also for other people inside the Israeli security establishment. And in doing so, further Israel's security and political interests. It's kind of an impressive sort of synergy between the two. And, you know, one thing I've neglected to mention as well, too, earlier, there's another story we did in here, which is about Epstein's ties to private banks, and specifically tied to very notorious or famous, however you want to put it, private bank, the Rothschild Group. Now, the Rothschild Group is a bank which is a private bank, Swiss private bank. It was very involved in the formation of the State of Israel. The Balfour Declaration, it's a very famous, you know, establishing the basis for the creation of the State of Israel in subsequent years, was actually a letter addressed to Edmund de Rothschild. That was at the origin of it. And the Rothschild Group has a very interesting relationship with the State of Israel today, wherein they have a long-term lease to the Israeli municipality of Caesarea, where they have the right to develop it, and the profits from their development will be reinvested in the Israeli education sector. And so it's a very, like, strange relationship. It's a very atypical kind of relationship. But Epstein had a very close relationship with Ariane Rothschild, current CEO of the Rothschild Group. And that wasn't reported first by Dropsy, it was reported by Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and others. But, you know, we saw in the story that Epstein was helping channel money from that bank into Israeli surveillance tech firms and cyber weapons firms, using his relationship with Barak as well, too. So all these things are happening at the same time. And they're happening like the same years, even 2013, 14. Our emails only span 2012, 2016. So it's only a snapshot of their lives. But they're doing all these things at once. So there was really no barrier per se between the desire to make money by Barak, the desire to support Israeli security and political interests and Israeli surveillance technology firms, and to just sort of operate the social network that Epstein was at the core of. They were all happening at the same time.
But would you say, was there something ideological pushing Epstein towards his dealings regarding these contracts or regarding Israel in general? Was there anything ideological kind of pushing him that you found from your reporting?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it. Epstein was somebody who was very, you know, pro-Israel, you could say. He was extremely interested in Israel's security interests. It was almost taken as a given that he would be. He would just naturally do things or seek out opportunities to further Israeli political and security interests during this time. He expressed views in his emails that comported with that on numerous occasions. And his actions were all geared around that as well, too. Now, it's not to say that he worked for the Mossad or something like that. I think he was actually much more powerful and influential than that. But he was part of this network of wealthy individuals around the world who were pro-Israel, who would seek out opportunities to benefit Israel, work with Israeli political figures like Barak and others to do that? Yeah.
Let me actually stop you on that one, because that is an important note, what you said about the Mossad, because as you know, in podcast land and all over the internet, there's been all kinds of things being said that he was allegedly a Mossad agent and whatnot. But it is interesting what you're saying. You're actually saying that he's more powerful than that. I just wanted to unpack that quickly with you.
Yeah, so, we're going to try to see if we can, write more stories about this to kind of explain the history of who Epstein was and so forth, and the networks that he emerged from and who he knew and he worked with and so forth. But, if I were to put it simply for the time being, there's like a network of billionaires, you could say. There's been reported in the past. It's something called the Study Group in the U.S. that was set up in the 90s by this like several dozen very powerful business magnates and so forth. Most of whom were very pro-Israel. That was kind of a central organizing interest that they had. And Epstein was tied to a particular gentleman named Les Wexner, or Leslie Wexner. He was a billionaire who became rich from fashion and consumer clothing goods. Victoria's Secret was one of the very important brands that he was associated with. And Epstein was made power of attorney over Wexner's fortune in the early 90s, and the circumstances, which are very, mysterious and really not very well known, were very surprising to people at the time, because he wasn't really anybody on paper at that time. But, he became basically a billionaire. He became effectively, the controller of this extremely powerful billionaire's fortune and philanthropic foundation as well, too. And by doing so, he became, very rich and powerful. Now, his title, if you were a Mossad agent or something like that, you're an employee in a hierarchy. You are somebody who's receiving a salary. You're answerable to the head of the Mossad. You're answerable, in theory, to the civilian government of Israel and so forth. And, that's, in a way, is an influential role, but in a way, you're kind of just an employee, as I said. You're kind of just someone, a cog in a machine and so forth. Epstein was definitely above and beyond that. He was part of this global transnational network of people who was free of any institutional constraints. He's not answerable to any civilian authorities and so forth. So, the Mossad, so to speak, in some way was very much beneath him. He was someone who had much more freedom to act, freedom, had more resources on a personal level by far than any, Mossad official, you could say.
Is it the opposite then? Did Mossad work for him?
It's more like that, yeah. It's more like, when you look at these emails of him and Barak, they were deploying these Israeli intelligence-linked firms, these foreign countries. There was no indication there that, that they even knew, the people he was deploying really knew what the whole story was, or who was pulling the strings, or what they were involved in, and so forth. They were kind of employees doing their job, being directed by these powerful guys. So it is more accurate to say what you said, that it was more like the Mossad was working for him, whether they knew it or not, to do this stuff. And it's very fascinating because Israel is kind of being used as like a base by people, and not just Israel, but also other countries like the UAE and other Gulf Arab countries. They were also arguably being used in the same way. They were like being used as sovereign bases for the storage and accumulation of capital and the deployment of military intelligence resources around the world. Somewhere you can hide out, somewhere you can, organize yourselves in a sovereign basis. And, it's kind of funny because in some way, like Israelis were also victims of Epstein in a sense, because their country was, I don't think if you're like selling falafel in Haifa or something, you are plugged into these conversations these billionaires are having and so forth. Their country is being used as a base outside the democratic purview of the Israeli government itself. So the citizens of the country had no real transparency or awareness of any of this. It was to the benefit, I guess, to Israel's security benefit as defined by some segment of the establishment, but more so to the benefit of this, transnational organization, or organization maybe is too formal a word, but this network of people, of which Epstein was a very, very important person. It was kind of more like organized crime. Which used certain countries and certain states as a basis.
I'm going to come back to Barack and Epstein now because, you know, again, I think the lack of media scrutiny or definitely legacy media scrutiny has allowed, because I'm sure you saw that there was a clip from the Halifax Forum in Canada where Barack was attending and someone asked him about the Jacobin article and he was, you know, quickly dismissive of it and obviously dismissive of his relationship with Epstein in general. He said he met him in 2003 and, you know, he regrets it or didn't really get into it. But I think the lack of media scrutiny is allowing for him to give that kind of answer without any follow-up.
I regret of ever meeting him. I was introduced to him in 2003 in a public event by Shimon Peres, and the event with hundreds of Americans, including the Clintons and many others.
And it's something that I, you know, as I'm hearing you talk, I find it, you know, fascinating because there's been so much media scrutiny given to someone like Prince Andrew here in the UK. And I'm not, you know, I'm as they should, you know, I'm not being dismissive of the media scrutiny towards Andrew at all or Prince Andrew, but it does seem like Barack was a lot closer to Epstein than Prince Andrew was.
Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned the Jacobin article that was brought up at the Halifax Forum in early December. There was also a separate event in New York at the New York Times Deal Book Summit where Nick Kristof, who's a New York Times columnist, actually brought up our reporting to Barack again. And he brought up the fact that Yoni Korn had been staying at Epstein's home to Barack in an interview. And you can look at that interaction. This just happened on, I think, Thursday the 4th. And, you know, it's funny because it was very interesting to me to see that because it shows that the, you know, the New York Times is paying attention to our reporting. They're bringing it up to Barack again in a public event, very high profile public event. But it was funny because Kristof actually brought it up, but he didn't. His subsequent question brought the subject back to whether Barack had been involved in the trafficking or abuse of young women with Epstein. That was kind of where his question about Korn was leading. And while I do think that is a very important question, that has been asked of Barack many times. And that has been something which has been known and discussed many times, including in this sort of right-wing pro-Israel media like the Post and the Daily Mail and so forth. And, you know, of course, Barack denied it, and he has sort of like a set answer to that. And I don't really know for sure what the truth is of that per se, but that's not really the most interesting, important question. The more interesting, important question, if you're going to read our reporting, and if you're going to talk to Barack or anyone else and ask them about the subject, is why was Epstein involved in these diplomatic deals with you and these intelligence deals with you? Who was Epstein to do this? Why were you relying on Epstein to set up talks with Vladimir Putin? What was Korn doing at your home? Not just what were you doing at home, what was Korn? What was your chief of staff and senior military intelligence officer, lifetime military intelligence officer doing in Epstein's home for these extended periods of time? Was he involved in blackmailing people? Those are the kind of questions that, you know, if you're going to talk to Barack, and black people are doing that in these public forums, they should be asking. And again, you know, to reiterate, it's not to downplay the gravity of the sex crimes charges, but we already know about all that. That's something we know about. And it's almost like at this point, what you'd call a limited hangout. And a limited hangout, you know, for people not familiar with the term, it's like an intelligence term. When there's a story out there, or a piece of information, which is extremely important, and the public knows about it and they want to know more, and you want to satiate their desire for it, you can give a little bit of it, the story. Take a little bit of the story and report it very thoroughly. And then you can get people to hopefully forget about the rest of it. So what they're doing is, you know, including in this interaction, they're bringing up this issue of Epstein's involvement in sex trafficking. They're reporting it and talking about it very thoroughly, almost ad nauseum. And then, but they're ignoring the entire other aspect of the story, which is potentially the more consequential aspect, or when viewed in conjunction with the sex trafficking, you know, even more sort of grave and so forth, which is, where was he an intelligence operative for who and doing what? Why was he doing this stuff for the state of Israel and so forth? I'd like to see people ask that question. And that question has not been answered by Barack or anyone else, whether at the Halifax Forum or the Deal Book Summit or in any other public interactions that I've seen today.
Well, let me actually read you this line from the correspondence between Epstein and Barack, which was included in your reporting. So this is from Epstein to Barack in the email, quote, with civil unrest exploding in Ukraine, Syria, Somalia, Libya, isn't this perfect for you? And then Barack responds, you're right in a way, but not simple to transform it into a cash flow. Again, I want to understand this exchange more from what you gathered from it.
Yeah, that email, we're going to cite it a lot in our stories for the simple reason that it kind of explains a lot of what's going on there and it's sort of indicative of their relationship and what they were doing and so forth. So what Epstein and Barack were doing in practice is that, so Barack left the Ministry of Defense post in 2013. He'd been in touch with Epstein long before that, you know, including these emails, working on different subjects together. But, you know, he wanted any money now also that he left his former role. So they were looking around the world at different parts of the world where there were governments that had internal security challenges or even external security challenges, whether that's from insurgencies, foreign threats, or just disloyalty or threats of coups inside their own establishments. And pitching Barack as someone who could solve their problems, Epstein would help introduce Barack to people as someone who could solve their problems. And the solution that they would put forward is that they would, Barack would propose these Israeli military contractors and surveillance technology firms to go into countries like Cote d'Ivoire and Nigeria or Mongolia or the other countries that they named in that email, and propose that these firms would come in and help build, you know, many cases, turnkey surveillance solutions for the country. And in the Cote d'Ivoire example, we have, you know, a map, a full document showing great detail what they propose to build for Cote d'Ivoire in that context. So, you know, it's like Epstein will connect you and help you have the talk and say, hey, this guy Barack can solve all your problems. And what's going to solve your problems is Israeli firms. And these Israeli firms are all heavily linked to Israeli intelligence. So you kind of go in and basically embed Israeli intelligence in the infrastructure, security infrastructure of these countries. And, you know, we've done these stories about these particular countries, but I think there are other countries as well, too. I think there's very strong indications that countries like the UAE and other Gulf Arab states are very, very embedded with Israeli security tech. And there were some reports about this, actually, when the Israelis struck Doha and the airstrikes earlier this year, that the Gulf Arab states were very upset about this. It freaked them out, not just in Qatar, but the other states as well, too. But there was a French intelligence official who spoke anonymously in an article. I remember seeing this. He said that even if the Arabs wanted to get the Israelis out now, if they were, you know, wanted to get cold feet about this relationship, even, let's say, in the UAE or something like that, they couldn't anymore because they're too embedded now in their security at the ports and security, the police infrastructure and so forth. And that embeddedness is sort of, you get a glimpse of that in these stories because they show you how they go to these countries and say, we'll build you a whole surveillance apparatus with these firms, which are tied to our own intelligence agencies. And then if you do that, how do you ever get them out now, if that's the case? If they have access to all your communications and they're running and building everything, getting them out is no easy feat. You could try to go to the Chinese to build something alternative. It's going to take a very long time. It's going to be very hard. You could have consequences in doing that. So, you know, that's kind of what they're going around doing. So, again, they're accomplishing two things. Like, Barack made money out of these deals. And by the way, Epstein showed no interest in making money. That's a very interesting part of this. He was loaning Barack money. He never really seemed to seek a cut of these deals for himself. It was really Barack.
I find that crazy too, Murtaza. I find that, again, that's so fascinating because Epstein, when he died, right, a few years back, his net worth was estimated at $600 million. And again, there's a lot of questions than answers. There's a lot more questions than answers when it comes to how this man made his wealth. And you're saying right now that he actually wasn't even interested in taking a cut out of these deals either.
No, he showed no interest in cut out of the deals. So, you know, Epstein had set up all these shell companies. We've talked about some of them in the stories, which were, you know, vehicles for his investments. He was very involved in like setting up philanthropic, quote unquote, entities for purposes of maybe tax evasion or concealing money for political purposes. But also to go back to what I said earlier, he was also the power of attorney over Les Wexner's fortune. So he effectively owned the fortune of Leslie Wexner, which is a very, very gigantic multi-billion-dollar fortune. And I've spoken to people who were in Epstein's social circles at this time, especially when he was in working with Harvard and academia and so forth, and you know, being a very big player in that world. And they would tell me interesting things, like, you know, Epstein, his behavior would not be like single-digit billionaires. Like, there was a way that single-digit billionaires acted, and there was a way that double-digit billionaires acted. And he acted more like a double-digit billionaire. Like, the way he'd throw money around, the way he would, you know, organize people or command attention or draw people into his orbit for certain purposes with authority. He would act like he was like a multi-billionaire, and the way he deployed resources and social capital even as well too. So I think the full accounting of his net worth and how much money he had and all that stuff, I think we haven't had a full story of that yet. Mm. But I do think it's very much tied to his relationship with Les Wexner and these other pro-Israel billionaires, these other, the study group I mentioned, also known as the mega group, his embeddedness in that world. I think it's very important to understand just how wealthy he was and why, you know, like, you know, first, I'll give you a quick example. Barack, in one of these emails, it shows him getting $1 million a quarter consulting gig with this Russian-Israeli oligarch based in Russia. That's a lot of money to most people, including Barack. You know, Barack, again, he's a very influential, powerful person, but, you know, $1 million a quarter is, you know, a significant chunk of change. Epstein had no interest in this sort of what to him was basically, you know, measly, you know, inconsequential amounts of money. He was helping Barack do that. And in doing so, you can imagine gaining a bit of leverage over Barack as well, too. But he sought no such deals for himself, and he never sought a cut from what we saw out of these deals for himself. He was far, far beyond that.
Talking about Russia, there is also an important thing that I'd like to highlight, which is the fact that both Barack and Epstein were involved in meetings with Putin in relation to, I guess, toppling Assad back in 2013. And they had aims to basically install, I guess even more so from Barack's part, is to have a pro-Russian leader in Syria that would also align with Israeli interests in the region. But I do want to talk about that because there was also an op-ed that Barack wrote. And then I think Epstein was involved in edits. And then that op-ed didn't actually get published, but it did get published, but without Epstein's edits and I think a British publication. But there's a lot here going on. I just want to talk about, with respect to Russia and Syria, what was happening in that moment.
So in 2013, you know, the war in Syria was escalating rapidly. It was deteriorating in terms of the Syrian government and Syrian society was starting to dissolve under the pressure of the war and the insurgency and so forth. So at this time, the Israelis really started getting worried about this because with the Assad regime, they had like a cold peace. They had like a security arrangement. The border was very quiet. They may not have had formal ties, but, you know, they had an understanding which was very durable and convenient for the Israelis. But the Syrian government was losing control seemingly at that time. And what was more alarming to the Israelis was that the Iranians were gaining influence in Syria at the expense of the Syrian government. And Hezbollah was increasing its, they believe, was increasing its footprint in Syria. Obviously, there's weapons transfers happening through Syria, through Syria to Lebanon from Iran. And, you know, they were concerned that this situation was going to get out of control and Syria was going to become just an entirely new front controlled by Iran, controlled by Hezbollah. Potentially, like, you know, the way southern Lebanon is, or Gaza was, like a hostile front with missiles pointed at them and so forth. They didn't want that to happen. So that's why you saw in years after that, they started carrying out a very extensive campaign of airstrikes inside Syria, including 2013, targeting alleged Iranian and Hezbollah weapons transfers in that country. But in 2013, they were really still figuring out how to deal with this, and they were freaking out. They were concerned about it. And the idea that Epstein and Barack came up with in their private correspondences is, hey, we have a good relationship with Russia. Epstein knows him very well. You know, Israel and Russia have good ties. Why don't we put a fork in this right now? It's 2013. Let's put an end to the situation. We need to get someone else in power who could put a stop to this insurgency in some way and just let us continue having the cordial cold peace between Syria and Israel. Well, it's just cordial, but the understanding that exists between Israel and Syria, and prevent Iran from expanding its influence in that country, which would be detrimental to us. So they didn't want to give an impression of formal Israeli communications with Russia at that time, which would be very provocative to other people. But they wanted to create is back channel diplomacy, which is very common in the diplomatic world. Create a situation where people who are known to be aligned with the Israeli security establishment and known to represent its views can reach out to the Russians and give an offer, so to speak, what an Israeli-Russian deal over Syria could look like. And again, a way you sort of lay the table for this in many cases is have a very powerful person publish a public op-ed about this, a public article about this, laying out an offer or a position, so to speak, for the subject. And Epstein and Barak, again, they worked together to write an article laying out what would be an Israeli offer to the Russians for how they'd like to see Syria play out in 2013. And Russia, Epstein and Barak write this op-ed. They go back and forth. The op-ed basically says, why doesn't Russia just push Assad aside, put in place another pro-Russian dictator who's going to keep the Iranians out, and we can move forward on that basis. And that was kind of the crux of the article. Epstein made suggestions in the article, which were even more hawkish and aggressive than Barak. And again, that's your earlier point that speaks to his own political views. He was a very, aggressive, hawkish, kind of pro-Israel guy, Epstein, trying to draw more U.S. involvement in the situation to confront Iran. And this op-ed was published ultimately in the UK Telegraph. And shortly thereafter, with Epstein's assistance, Barak went to Moscow and met with senior Russian officials to discuss this deal. Now, shortly after these discussions, there was the Ghouta chemical weapons attack in Syria. And that seemed to completely throw the situation for a loop again. And then, we do see further discussions in there that Epstein was hoping that this would lead to U.S. congressional authority for the U.S. to attack Syria, but also to attack Iran as well, too, directly.
Right. Because that was the one, if I'm not mistaken, where Barack Obama drew a red line, right? I think it was
Barack Obama drew a red line, said that if chemical weapons are used in Syria, we will attack Syria. Yeah. The weapons were used, but Obama did not proceed with a regime change war in Syria, so to speak, nor did he attack Iran at that time either. So whatever was going on there, it did not work out the way that Epstein and Barak had hoped. The things did not really execute in that sense. And it took a decade later, after many other confrontations and wars, that the Assad regime was finally replaced by a different regime, which Israel also doesn't like. So, I think the important part of that story is just that it showed that Epstein was involved at a very, very senior level in helping manage Israel's response to the Syria situation and its diplomacy with the Russians, as well as pushing for the U.S. to take a harsher line against not just Syria, but Iran as well.
Could someone like Barak, as this story gets bigger and makes more noise, could someone like Barak face any kind of repercussions because of his relationship with Epstein, because of these kind of deals that they were doing or the correspondence? I mean, I know we touched earlier on the fact that this might not really be a scandal in Israel per se on Barak's part. And I'm here referring specifically about Barak's relationship with Epstein regarding the intelligence services. I'm not talking about anything related to the other sex-related crimes. On Epstein's part. Could he face any kind of repercussions because of this relationship?
Well, here's the thing. Like, in a way, if you look at it from an Israeli perspective, Barak was doing his patriotic duty to help Israel throughout his life, even after leaving public service. And I think some people in Israel don't really like the fact that he's become like an oligarch. He has a lot of money from that thing that's annoyed people. And there's a lot of ups and happiness about, including on the Israeli right, where Barak is not very popular. But I think that they won't really be bothered by what he was doing, in as much as he can characterize it as being beneficial to Israel's political interests, helping build up Israel's security surveillance sector, which Epstein and Barak both did together. All that is positive from their perspective. The issue that's not positive is that association with Epstein in general has become this sort of liability now anywhere in the world. So now they're saying, why did you drag Israel into the relationship with this maybe the world's most notorious sex trafficker through these activities. So that could be harmful to them, but I think they're going to try to avoid that. They're going to try to avoid that part of the story, and they're going to leave everything down to the subject of what was going on with these girls, what people know, what did Barack do, and so forth, and leave the role of who Epstein was, who Barack was, and why they were engaging in these activities and how they were doing it separate. Because if I were to imagine, there's probably a lot of billionaires who are doing things with Israeli officials to further their interests. I'm almost certain that there are. In the context of these, you know, pro-Israel mega group billionaires working with their Israeli counterparts to further Israeli interests around the world. So I think that aspect of it is probably not controversial. I think they probably like what Epstein was doing, you know, and they just didn't like the fact that it became this embarrassment later on because of his other activities.
It is interesting, though, that Barack and other powerful figures that were around Epstein, it's interesting that the 2008 sex offender conviction that Epstein got didn't really deter any of these powerful figures from having a relationship with him.
It seems like there was no impact on people's views of Epstein in his own elite social circles, as far as I can tell, and people interacting, actually asking for dating advice after, joking around with him about his proficiency with the ladies and his romantic life, so to speak. So it was kind of like a big joke. And, you know, Arianna, the head of the Rothschild Bank, when she was asked about this by Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal, I think the bank claimed that she never knew about it. And, you know, that's really, it almost defies, it's almost insulting the level of dismissal of public concerns on the subject. So, yeah, it didn't bother them. It was probably still going on some degree. There's indications that, you know, if not child sex trafficking, certainly he was trafficking women for different purposes. That's something which has allegedly gone on for many years after his conviction. So, you know, no, yeah, I think they didn't care. I think they saw themselves above those concerns. And even him getting in trouble for that, it's interesting how that happened because, you know, there was some way, means by which he evaded any serious legal repercussions. He did get this 18-month suspended sentence, and he served part of it, partially suspended sentence. He served part of it in jail, but most of it was on home leave anyways, work leave for the most part, and then he was back to business. So, yeah, it didn't seem to be much of an impediment to his connections in life.
I also want to ask you about India before I let you go, Murtaza, because there was some reporting that you guys did on that as well. Firstly, why is it that Epstein had his sights on India? From my understanding is that he wanted basically Steve Bannon to meet with Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India. Was this also part of some pro-Israel strategy?
Yeah, so this story was actually not based on the Barack Epstein emails. It was also based on the House Oversight Committee documents. And the reason we reported it was because the story, when these emails came out, it became a big deal in Indian media. And people were concerned that Indian officials were benefiting from Epstein's sex trafficking at this time. That was kind of the social media response to it, and even the government was forced to respond to it on that basis. But actually, I think the emails don't show that per se. Not to say it was or was not going on, that's just not what the emails show. But they did show that Epstein was involved in helping set up meetings for Bannon while Bannon was on a trip to India. And from what he described in the emails, and again, Epstein was not very, he's kind of very abrupt in his emails. He kind of like made a lot of typos. He was not very explanatory in his emails per se. I think he explained the reasons for that in a different context. But yeah, he indicated that this was related to something to do with ties with Israel. So one could surmise that perhaps that he saw building ties between U.S. elites and Indian elites as part of a broader goal of bringing together a pro-Israel compact in U.S. and Indian politics and holding them in power for the benefit of Israel, which is something that Epstein was very involved in. So I think that, you know, you can look at the story, you can read it in Drop 10 News, and you can see that he was involved in these setting up these meetings and so forth. I think that, you know, it adds more weight to the fact that Epstein was someone who was very actively, to the end of his life, involved in helping promoting Israeli interests. But also, again, it lends the question, how is Epstein the person who had the sway and the pull to set up meetings between powerful figures all over the world, including India? And, you know, I'll add one final thing, that his calendars also showed, you know, BJP officials meeting with him quite regularly in New York. So, again, that whole context of how he had that power and who he was has by no means been addressed in the broader reporting about him. And I think it's something we need to drill into more, how he became this powerful person and what interests he represented and why.
And the fact that India today is the largest purchaser of Israeli arms, do you think Epstein had a role in that relationship as well, in terms of that, how that turned out?
No, I try to be very conservative in my conclusions and so forth from based on the evidence we have. But, you know, one can surmise that there is been this blossoming up in Israeli-Indian security relationship over the years. Epstein was also working on apparently meeting with Israeli and sorry, not meeting with Indian officials while working on behalf of the Israeli government. So I think that, you know, this could be a confluence of factors, and I don't want to state that Epstein was the crux of it per se, but he certainly was someone who had the connections who could help facilitate that. And again, everything we report on Epstein is based on very fragmentary correspondence that we have that was released by hackers over a set period of time from a certain inbox with a certain person. There's a whole broader range of activities and meetings he was involved in, which have not come out in the Epstein files from the government and are not, maybe never come out per se, or may never come out through official channels at least. So we don't really know everything he was doing. I think it's a reasonable thing to look into though. And I think he would be someone who would be in a position and have the motivation to promote those kind of ties between New Delhi and Tel Aviv.
Yeah, and that would be, this would be my last question, Murtaza, because the fact of what we know and what we don't know, do you think we're only scratching the surface at this point? Do you think there's going to be a lot more coming out when it comes to Epstein's relationship with countries like Israel, other, you know, countries as well?
Well, you know, there's the analogy of the blind person or the group of blind people touching an elephant. You know, if you're familiar with this analogy, it's like everyone's touching the elephant from a different part and everyone's feeling a different thing. And no one's able to tell what they're touching or able to understand fully what the story is. So, you know, I don't think that we all have portions of this. And even everything DropSides reported, and I think say the DropSides reported, I think the most important stuff about Epstein, if anyone to date, arguably, it's only part of the story. And, you know, again, it's very fragmentary. We are now nowhere close to understanding what the full elephant is in this situation. The elephant that who he was, what he did, and what he represented. If I were to give you what I think it is, I think there is this nexus of very powerful, rich people around the world. It's not that big of a group of people. They kind of have a parastatal way of organization, for similar to organized crime. And he was like a member of this community of people. And there were people who were Israelis and Russians and Arabs and Africans and Americans, Europeans, and so forth. And they had certain interests. And one of the interests was defending Israel and things like that, among other things as well, too. So, you know, he was like a mafioso in this mafia. That was what I see him as, and I think the most likely explanation. And again, we're going to report more about this, and we're going to do stories about Epstein's history, which were being filled in by some of the new emails we got as well, too. But, you know, he was basically, he got a start as a money launderer. He was someone who was a very effective money launderer. He was tied to people like Adnan Khashoggi and people like this who were involved in money laundering.
The Saudi arms dealer. Yeah.
An arms dealer, and he seemed to learn that trade. And money laundering is a tool which is very useful. It's very lucrative, but it's also very useful to intelligence agencies who need to create off the books budgets to book and do certain things they don't want people to know about, like Iran-Contra. And you know, so, and money laundering is a crime, and I think he was somebody who was involved in that and proficient at that, and it put him in this world of people, very powerful people, whom he continued serving and acting among until the end of his life.
That's all interesting stuff, but we're going to leave it here. Murtaza Hussain, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk. Appreciate you, appreciate your reporting, and appreciate all the time you've given us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.